Okay, I sent an email to the class list, which is actually on the webpage there, on giving both the information about how the points were divided for the project and what are the averages for undergraduate and graduate. Yes, sir. Yeah, 15, 30, 46. Yeah, I guess so. Did you guys get out of 60 or out of 55? Out of 60. Okay, then it's 60 plus 5. Okay. Yeah. Actually, you are saying this is with respect to without extra credit and 60. So that's a mistake. And then there are some comments by the TA on what he thought. You know, people did in terms of what they did well, what they didn't do well at a high level in terms of for the entire group. Okay, so you can look at that. Okay. So apparently, pretty much the average is quite high, and most people who did it seem to have done it fine. That's the lesson seen here. Okay. Okay, so I sent a mail asking people if you have any questions on the last time's discussion, you should ask me questions. Are there any comments, questions? Everything is just as crystal clear as it always is. Yes, sir. What? Open and closed world, the difference, so who got that? What's the difference between open and closed world? Yes? Okay. Okay. So the basic idea is closed world, I mean open world versus closed world is a question of whether the database is making a statement about its completeness. Okay, so if something is not in the database, then does that mean that, so for example, I have the database is storing the relation movies, which have movies, directors of the movies, actors and all that stuff. So if a particular movie entry does not exist in the database, can I be sure that in fact that movie was never made? That's the question. Okay. If the database, normally that database have to make an extra statement over and above the tuples they store as to whether they think they are complete or not.
How does this affect in terms of mediators?
Because if you have, if you are looking for, let's say, all the movies made in 1969, okay, and so you went to IMDb and you found a bunch of movies that were made in 1969, so the question is, should you have to call any other movie database? Yes, so the open versus closed world assumption is either the database or you, I mean you have extra knowledge about the database other than what the database is exporting as to whether it's open world or closed world. Okay, databases can actually say it, but there's a question as to if the database says it, are we supposed to believe it? There is that question. In fact, you know, it's actually likely, more likely than not, that commercial interests will say that everybody would claim closed world. You know, if we don't have it, then you don't need to bother. But it's important to actually, so it is important to know, first of all, that whether or not the database is complete matters in terms of query processing. Okay, and the other thing that I was making is, the point I was making is that sometimes you may not be able to say this is the local closed world assumption, local completeness assumption that I just discussed last class without a slide and I put in a slide. So sometimes we may not actually be able to provide a completeness statement for the entire database, but might be able to provide completeness statement for pieces of the database. Okay, so in fact, I'd like to think of this picture, which is actually something that helps me, okay, which is every database claims way more than it actually can deliver. This is the advertised description. Okay, so suppose if it's IMDb, you'll say, I have all the movies that has ever been made. Okay, so that's the only way you would claim. And then they can also say that, so nobody really has to believe it. Okay, they can also say that there are aspects of this database over which we definitely are complete. Okay, so they can say that we are complete for all the Hollywood movies. We are complete for all the movies made by a particular director. Now, it's a question as to whether they are supposed to make these statements or you are supposed to find out these statements yourself. Okay, but this is also extra information about the sources that are useful in query processing. Okay, and in fact, we will actually, this whole entire notion of complete, the completeness issue, we would convert it from complete versus not complete to the percentage coverage. That's what we'll discuss, you know, much of today's class. We'll talk about coverage of a source with respect to a query. Okay, 100% coverage versus 10% coverage versus 90% coverage. Then you would say open and closed world are really two extremes of that. And of course, nobody gives you those coverage statistics either, but we learn them. We basically probe the sources and learn them. So in some sense, local closed world assumption should also be learned. Okay. So actually, these problems are put here to kind of motivate talking about quantitative coverage overlap statistics. And so the point is, sources may not actually be interested in telling you that they are only complete on something less than what they are advertising. There's no advantage for them to do this, okay, at least in commercial sense. So then you would have to learn. And these are pretty hard things to learn. Learning that something is definitely complete for a particular subset of the database is harder to learn than learning that it's like 0.9 probability. With 0.9 probability, it'll give you all the answers to this query, which are basically coverage and overlap statistics. We'll look at it in a minute. Okay. And then there's this other issue of what is the level at which the completeness statements can be made. For example, you could make completeness statements that are too low a level of granularity. So for example, you can say, I definitely have all the cars which have the vehicle ID this. And that would be potentially useless because there are going to be as many such statements as there are number of cars because each one has a different ID. Okay. But I think going back to the issue of open versus closed world, it has an effect on the query processing. Now, that brings us to the question, why weren't we worried about open versus closed world assumptions in traditional databases? Why didn't you think about it before? I mean, you guys did databases before. Can somebody keep the door open? I feel claustrophobic. I feel you guys are going to do something bad to me if the lecture doesn't go well. What? Oh, really? No, they don't get to do that. Yeah, I know, but you know, anyway, so what was I saying? Actually, in fact, I think if the door is not open, I can't convince myself that the sun is out there, so I feel as if I'm a martyr, you know, teaching like a evening session for a bunch of people who don't want to be here. So it's kind of hard, so I need to see that there is sun. I mean, people in Arizona can't live with sun and can't live without sun, so that's our life. Yeah, there was a question, I forgot now. Why don't we care about open and closed world statements in? Yes. Yeah, so there's no question of asking any other database, really. In fact, you would have to care even, so there are two real reasons actually. There is one technically deep reason as to why you don't care, and there's one technically shallow reason as to why you don't care. The shallow reason is there's only one single database. So if this guy is not complete, who are you going to ask? So you might as well just assume whatever this database gives is what you get to take. Okay, but there was another reason I brought up last class as to why open versus closed world assumption makes a difference. Which is, I mean, there are two different reasons. One is get as many answers as possible. There is another reason. Negation. Okay, suppose I want to ask the question, give me the names of all the movies not made by Woody Allen, which is like too many movies, but, you know. Okay, so if I ask that kind of question, negation question, then you are out of luck. Now, why don't you care about this? Because SQL doesn't have very good negation semantics. What? You can ask, but the question is, so the idea is that, once you start having negation, okay, you'll start getting into logic programming. Okay, to give proper, you can always say whatever is not there, you know. So in some sense, when you are answering a negation, a query with negation, you are taking a stance on whether it's open world or closed world. No, but I mean, that's not necessarily right. That's what I'm saying. So, you know, in the first case, you don't have to care about whether you took a stance or not. You know, you only have one database, so you just use it. Okay? And whatever answers it can give. But in the second case, you are, in answering a query with negation, you're taking a stance on whether it's closed world or open world. Okay? And nobody, in fact, it's a big deal for logic programming, deductive databases and so on. But in SQL, people just hope that, okay, whatever you get is what you get. So semantics for negated queries and recursive queries are all out the window. Okay, yes. In the case of open world database, you actually cannot be sure so the idea is, suppose you have asked this question, let's see, how do you do this? For the case of open world database. I'm trying to think of a telling example. So you are asking whether or not, your query has a negation in it, okay? So give me all the movies that were not made in 1969. And so you look at all the movies, remove the movies made in 1969 that you know for sure are made in 1969, and the rest you assume are the answers. The question is, what if some of the movies you are returning have been made in 1969. So I have to make a good example for you. I'll try to make it and give you. In essence, you have to assume to do the negation. You have to assume that you're worried whether or not the tuples not satisfying. I don't know. I'll give you an example. Sorry, let me not get confused more. Other questions? Yes.
How do you know, for the negator, you need to know that the schema of the source?
Which one? Where are the sources, you mean?
We have some sources, suppose, for negator. And the negator has to know the schema, it's the root side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem that is seen on the site before was that you cannot know the schema of the source, so it might not be able to study the data.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. I mean, I don't think it's a problem. I mean, if you look at enough, so first of all, the sources may not give the schema. Okay, they may give you tuples. Okay, and learning, learning the schema from tuples is hard if in fact the sources have possibly null values. Okay, for example, if the sources have XML schema, so if you saw five tuples, each of them have one author for a book, okay, does that mean that all book tuples will have exactly one author? Will they have exactly two authors? Will they have as many authors as you want? Okay, so there is a question of induction. You're inducing the schema from the tuples that you have seen. It's much easier if the source actually gives you upfront that this is the actual restrictions on the schema. Okay. No, mediator inserting tuples into the database, and the other database, that's the right issue. I mean, I'm not even sure whether you're allowed to write into the outside sources. So this issue of information integration, it depends on how general you want to make it. You know, you could start with just a query. And then the first issue would be, what are the potential sources on the internet that might be relevant? The second issue would be, what are their schemas? The third issue would be, how do I map those schemas into, I mean, how do I use the sources to answer my query? Okay, now these can be done for individual queries at a time. In fact, that brings me to one of my questions, which is, information integration is being done all the time on the web. So you guys know this Google mashups, the Google Map mashups, which everybody talks about now. It's in essence, you know, Gmaps has made available its API, right? And so what people do, in essence, is they take information from some other database, and then they allow you to visualize that information on the web, on the map. So for example, there is a flight tracking software which takes information about current real-time placement of flights, you know, longitude, latitude, placement of flights, which are available in public databases. Okay, and then it throws it into Google Map, and so you can then show that pushpin thing in the Google Map. That's an integration of two different databases.
Housemapping.com.
What?
Housemapping.com.
Yeah. So many of these things are actually these parts of, I mean, I don't know, these mashups, I'm not sure whether it's made for just Gmaps or pretty much anything, but in general, you're taking two different things, and you know, you can put a link from an address information somewhere into a Gmap API, so that you can then see the location for this. I would say that you are integrating information across different sources here, and it's clear that it's useful. In fact, for Google Map mashup, there's one guy who actually maintains like a blog or a list of the current latest number of things that are available. Mashups that are available for Google Maps. And there are all sorts of, I think I may have sent you guys this article as to how, for example, Google made it open, and they're also saying that at some point of time they will start charging for use of the service. So if somebody who has these mashups on their homepage are getting a lot of traffic, and then they wind up making money off of it by putting Google advertisements on their homepage, then at this point, Google doesn't say anything, but after a while they say they want a piece of it, they might want a piece of it, okay? But anyway, so these are actual integrations that are being done. But the difference between, so what is the difference between these and the kind of thing that we are discussing here?
Those are pretty highly structured.
It's not just highly structured, it's you're doing it. It's hand-coded. The word is hand-coded. The issue that we are interested in is how much of information integration can be automated. One extreme case is full automation. So all I do is there is a universal mediator. I just go there with my query. The mediator quickly rounds up all the sources that are relevant, finds out what their schemas are, figures out how to map them onto its currently ad hoc mediator schema, takes your query, reformulates it into those sources, gives you the answer. That's one full extreme. The other full extreme is you have this query, you think, you know, I have nothing else to do for the next few hours. You know, I will just write a little script, which if I have this query again tomorrow, I can answer this without having to, you know, take the address from here and plug it into the API here. Okay, that's completely hand-coded for that one particular query you have, one particular type of query you have. Here you have this idea of making it much more general. This is very uninteresting except for that query. That is probably undoable. It's too general. But in some sense, what we are spending time on is what parts can be automated. Okay, and what would be the issues involved in automating it. Okay, even if you want to do semi-automation, suppose you say, I'll let the users tell me what are the right sources, and they may even give me the schemas, and I still need to map the schemas, which is basically what the Transformic company was trying to do. They're assuming that they have employment advertisement, and they would do some induction and say, well, this is the structure of the advertisement after they see a couple of them. And then they have to map that to their mediator schema. Okay. So I think, so there's another question about this is, would this, what would this, if you were to forget about the fact that this hand-coded, is this more like data aggregation or more like data linkage? Remember I had these four things? Data linkage. Most mashups are actually data linkage. You know, somebody has some specific interesting query and they just connect up a couple of data sources just to answer that type of query. So it's more of a horizontal thing. Okay, except it's hand-coded. I mean, it's like there is no declarative schema for the source one or source two. You're just feeding in, you know, data from here into the input for this program. Okay, the question is how can you automate more of this? Okay. So there's this thing, this mtalk.com, actually you can look it up. It's Amazon, I think Hassan Dalchu pointed this out to me. It's an interesting site where they are essentially doing humans, they're helping, they're paying humans to do many of the information extraction tasks. So this is the capitalist version of the collaborative computing. We talked about collaborative computing as a big thing. And so they will ask for example, in this picture, where is the restaurant? And then you get to map it there, and then if you do it, then you get like 60 cents or 20 cents or 30 cents or whatever. And apparently now they closed it up because people are making too much money. And also there's this other issue. I haven't gone through it more carefully, but the question is if I were to map it, if they don't have, they don't know for sure whether they have the answer right or not. Right? Somebody else has to actually check the veracity of what I said, which is still pretty bad, right? It's, if you're trying to reduce the number of Amazon employees wasting time on doing this stuff, you didn't, because they still have to check whether what people did is right or not, okay? But it's still an interesting idea. So they call this artificial intelligence, so AAI. So we're just going around circles. I mean, I remember this quote, which I normally mention in 471 Plus, attributed to what's his name, Werner von Braun, which I forget now exact wording, but essentially it says something to the effect that the most general purpose computers manufacturable by unskilled labor still remain human beings. Okay, so we can use that as background for, you know, getting back to this thing. Okay. Any other questions on what we discussed last time? Yes.
The kinds of data linkage we've talked about so far are fairly simple. For instance, the mashups.
Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining most of those kinds of situations, they're actually just somehow getting straight from the database where they're getting their data, the latitude and longitude, then mapping it right in, or they're finding some sort of middleware where they're middle database where they're doing a place name lookup to do a latitude and longitude. I've done a little work on some of the words which are a lot more difficult. And I'm not finding a whole lot of research that's out there.
Okay.
Is there
See the problem with most of these internet problems is, I mean, that they are internet versions of many long-standing problems, right? I mean, so IR, basically the notion of textual search, the best way to do it is actually doing natural language understanding, okay? And so you're just putting it in the web version. You're putting it on the internet of NLP, okay? The same sort of situation happens in terms of generally coercing output from some random program into input for some other random program, okay? In cases where there are well-defined APIs, you know, well-defined data types, you can do it, okay? That's the easy part, except if there are enough easy parts that you can do, people could be happy. That's what mashups are saying. But the problem that you have might involve there is input coming out here, the output coming out here, and there's some interpretation that needs to be done before you then decide what to enter into this. Okay, now that's a much harder version, and I don't think the fact that we are now on the internet doesn't make that problem go away. It's just that it makes it probably more interesting to put money into solving it to the extent there are more customers to use it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I think you sent me a mail, I need to get back to you on that, but in general, I think it's worth keeping in mind, and to some extent that's the reason it's fun to teach this course for me, because it has open problems of lots and lots of disciplines, and so I get to do open problems of networking in one class, open problems of database in another class, open problems of machine learning in another class, and it's more fun than just doing open problems of one particular discipline. Okay, it's cross-cutting. In fact, in many schools, this is given, this course is done, versions of this course are done as capstone courses, which sort of brings together 20 different things that you may have learned. About the only thing that we're not bringing together is actual hardware issues, but even those are important for things like Linux clusters and so on. Okay, so let's continue more, and so we were talking about these things last time, okay, and then I said we will talk about two approaches for, in essence, mapping a source schema onto mediator schema, and as soon as I said this, you know that of the large problem that I need to automate, I have already assumed that I know what are the sources, I've already assumed I know what are their schemas, I already decided what my mediator schema is, I'm just concentrating on how to map these schemas into this schema. Okay, that's basically at the level I'm talking about. Okay, so if I have that, it's an interesting problem for which there's a lot of work done on this, and so I thought I'll give you an idea as to what are the issues involved in that kind of mapping. As I said, there are two broad approaches which actually sort of define two extremes in how to map the source schemas onto the mediator schema. Okay, now assume that you get to decide what your mediator schema is upfront, and the sources get to decide what the source schema is upfront, and then you're talking about how they are connected, how to map them. Okay, now one basically is global as view, and one is local as view, and the word view comes in both places. So the question is, when you have two schemas, okay, you can think of one schema as a query on the other schema. Okay, it's basically a subpart of the other schema. Okay, a view on the other schema, and a view really is best seen as a query. Okay, that's how you think of views in databases. Okay, so global as view essentially assumes that the mediator schema is exactly the tight union of the sources. That's it. So whatever the mediator can give is exactly the union of whatever the sources can give. Okay, not just in terms of the schema itself. Okay, and then local as view essentially says the mediator schema is whatever it is, and every source schema is written as a view on the mediator schema. So in one case, the mediator schema is written as a view on the source schema. On the other case, you're doing the opposite way. The source schema is being written as a view on the mediator schema. Okay? I'll go through some examples, and then you can see the difference between them. Now, so we'll talk about it in the context of, let's say, a movie database scenario. But make sure that you understand, just remember that these are these ideas of views. So a view, in at least in the relational databases, is just a named query. It's a named query. Okay. Now the real question is there are two types of views. One is virtual view, and the other is materialized view, right? What's the difference? One actually, materialized means it's actually been materialized. Okay, so the tuples that are the answers to this query have been separately stored in a separate database. Virtual view is just a storefront. Okay, it says I'm going to give you this, and as soon as you ask it, give me, then it'll actually go quickly to the real database, get the tuples for that. Okay, so in the case of virtual view, there is no local maintenance at all. Okay, in the case of materialized view, but on the other hand, it has to, for every query, it has to essentially go to the real database. And in the case of materialized view, it's sort of a cache. And so you need to update it, you need to make sure that, from the point of view of databases, you need to make sure that the consistency between the materialized view and the main database is maintained. Okay, so that's from the database literature itself. So now we'll see how that's connected to what we want to do. One thing I want to mention here before I go on forward is, as small as this problem seems to be, if you look at it from the point of view of completely automated information integration, where you have to discover sources, you have to figure out what their schema is, and then you get here. Okay? It turns out it's way more general than what most people are actually doing, even in automated information integration, such as data aggregation. The kinds of things like employment opportunities and so on. One of the issues is there, basically there's only single relation in the mediator schema. And so everybody, in essence, is just sending pieces of this single relation. Okay, so keep this data aggregation example in the back of your head while I go through examples of global as you and local as you in the context of, you know, movie database, where there actually you wind up having multiple relations in the mediator schema and multiple relations possibly in the local sources. Okay, that's more general than what we need. And it turns out that, in fact, a lot of differences between global as you and local as you, however interesting they are and however many papers have actually been written on this, they wind up being not all that important if your problem is data aggregation. You see what I'm saying? Okay. So keep that in the back of your mind. And it also explains why I don't plan to spend some other part of the things that I used to do on this, I'm not going to do this year, because it seems to me that more of the work that's actually being currently done is on data aggregation systems rather than this sort of integration. But still worth knowing that, I think, at this level of the mapping differences. So, okay, so you have a mediator schema. So we are talking about a bunch of, we decided that we will mediate over some movie databases, right? So I have decided that my mediator schema is this: movie, title, director, year, genre, okay? And schedule, cinema, title, time. These are the two relations, these are the two tables that are there in the virtual schema. So the user gets to ask any SQL queries based on these two tables. That's basically what I'm saying. Okay, now assume now that I have found that basically I rounded up three sources which seem to have movie databases, movie information. Okay, so S1 is, this is one source which basically has, it basically is giving tuples of the form title, director, year, genre. Okay, and this one is giving title, director, year, genre again. So this is exactly the same thing. Okay, the tuples of these forms. And there is another source which gives two relations, title, director, and title, year, genre. Because sources also can have multiple relations, right? Okay. So the question then is, how do I connect these to these? Okay, how do I connect these relations S1, S2, S3 to the relations movie and schedule? That's all I want. Okay. So the globalized view, in essence, says that it provides, it in essence thinks this and this are virtual views on these actual sources. So it thinks these are the real databases, and this is just a storefront for these guys. Okay? So you essentially write it as create view of movie as, so you have a named view called movie, which really is this SQL query. Select all the tuples from S1, union select all the tuples from S2, union select S3 title, S3 director, S4 year, S4 genre, okay, where S3 title equal to S4 title. This is what? This is a join that's happening here. So you do join on these two, okay? And if you union the tuples from here, here, and here, that's exactly what you have in your movie table. Now, it doesn't look like this is, you know, too hard, but the important point to understand is you really assume that the movie, the relation movie is really written as a view on these sources. Okay? And so now if the user actually writes a query on movie, you know, it writes an SQL query on movie, all that happens is during the query runtime, all the views get inlined. So you essentially, where there's a view, wherever there's movie occurring, you wind up putting the view definition of movie in. That's all. So it's like, think of movie is really a named macro now in the point of view of C language sort of a thing. And it just gets inlined into the query. So the user gets to think that they're only asking questions in terms of movies and schedules and not in terms of S1, S2, S3, S4. And yet the answers are really basically, the queries are then very quickly converted into queries on these S1, S2, S3, S4. Okay? So that's one way, and that's basically the global as view. The other version essentially is local as view, where you turn the thing around. What you're going to do now is, actually I think I changed the example a little bit here, but what you're going to do now here is you write each source as an actual, as a materialized view on this virtual mediator schema. So it's sort of interesting. So what we are saying is, really, movies, there is an objective database out there, which doesn't exist, unfortunately, of all the possible movies in the world. And a piece of that table is stored here. A projected piece of that table is stored here. Another piece of that table is stored here. Okay, so for all the movies that are possible in the world, certain pieces are actually stored in these sources. And I'll explain to you, in writing my views, my sources as views, I essentially show you which piece corresponds to, which piece of this relation is actually stored in each of the sources. Okay, so for example, in this case, I'm saying create source S1 as basically selecting all tuples from the movie. Okay, that's the view. Now, it's basically, whatever it's giving are tuples from the movie. May not be all the tuples, but it's giving tuples from the movie. Okay, and then similarly, in this case, S3 is selecting title and director from the movie and stored it. And S5 selected title, director here from the movie where the following constraints are satisfied. And that's what it's storing here. Okay, so in this case, I have allowed, so upfront you should be able to see that I have allowed in this case the mediator schema to be much bigger than what I have ever seen as yet. It's more open-ended. So if there's one more source that winds up keeping all the titles and years for years, year greater than 1995. Okay, I want to throw that in. All I need to do is I just define one more view for that source. So I just wind up having some more coverage for this movie table. Okay, there are parts of the movie table that are not being supported by anybody. There are parts that are being supported by multiple people. Okay, the movie table itself can be theoretically as big as it needs to be, but the only things that I actually have are the pieces that are supported by various caches. Okay, so this is like the following thing. Remember the, how many of you, have you thought of this idea of running queries on databases when you have local caches? What you wind up doing in those cases normally is the caches are over and above the main database, right? So either you can run this entire query on the main database, or if pieces of the query can be run on the cache, can be run faster, then what you wind up doing is you reformulate your query such that you can exploit the caches where they are available, and then the rest is being run on the main database. Okay? The word cache essentially says there is a safety net. The final database is still there. If you don't want to use the cache, you still have final database. This idea is exactly like caches in the databases, except there is no database. You only have caches. So at one time, imagine that there was a virtual database of all movies and schedules exist, a real database of all movies and schedules existed. At that time, these guys, different ones of these, have picked up, you know, tuples from that particular big database and stored them. And then, you know, they took down this big database out. So now all you have of this database are these pieces. Okay, so that's an interesting conceptual issue. What that means now is if there are extra sources, then you can actually easily accommodate them without changing the mapping. Because you now have one more guy supporting one more piece of the bigger table, big table. Okay, now that discussion almost makes you realize that global as view is actually less modular than this, right? If I have to change, if I have to add an extra source in global as view, in essence, I'm changing this mapping. Okay, whereas if I'm adding an extra source in local as view, I just have to add the mapping for that source. That's it, separately. Now nobody else is affected. None of the other sources are affected. Okay. So that's a reasonable point about, the modularity, about the two approaches. One is more slightly more modular. Now, the trickier issue, which is actually the one that I could have spent a lot more time on, is the following. If I have this mapping, local as view mapping, and if somebody asks me a query on the main database, how do I convert it into queries onto the individual source? So think of what is happening now is, again, think of my analogy. At one time, there existed the total information database about movies, okay? And various people just, this is beautiful. Do you guys remember Fahrenheit, the other Fahrenheit? 411, not the 9/11. Fahrenheit 411. How many of you know what is Fahrenheit 411? Okay. It's a beautiful book where, in a world where people start banning books, Ray Bradbury wrote this, you know, where people start banning books. So there is libraries, and the libraries are being, you know, closed because the books are being banned. And so individual people become specific books. So they don't want the knowledge to be lost, so they wound up reading pieces of the library. And so this guy would be Anna Karenina. This guy would be some other classic book. And so the only knowledge that left are the copies of the original library. Okay, somehow I just got remember that. So think of that in sort of a scenario here. You had an original database, and only pieces are left now. Now the questions you have are still on the original database, which doesn't exist. And you want to ask, to what extent can those questions be answered given only the projections of the database that exist, the views on that database that exist? Okay, not surprisingly, that's a harder problem than the other one, where you say what the only thing that is there is what is available in these sources, nothing more, nothing less. Okay, So the view reform, the query reformulation in localized view is actually much more interesting, and making guarantees on the reformulation wind up being harder. That's the part that I'm going to skip. You know, there are slides on this, you can read more of it, but I would skip that for this class. But I want to mention one more thing between globalized view and localized view, which is, remember I said this notion of lossy versus lossless mediation. Okay, so when I'm making a mapping, I want to be able to make sure that everything that is actually answerable by going directly to the sources is still answerable by going through the mediator. Otherwise, the mediator is actually not a good mediator. It's losing some of the query. It's basically unable to answer some of the queries that can be answered if you go directly. So I want to show you at least a single example which sort of shows that in this example, basically you'll see that one of them is lossy and the other is not lossy. Okay, so consider the scenario where you again have movie and schedule as the virtual schema, and there's only one source this time. Only one source, and that's cinema and genre. Okay, now the interesting thing is if you're doing globalized view, right, you already decided, so these things have been decided. This is movie and schedule is your relations here, and the source S4 is this. If you're doing globalized view, you have to write movie as a view on this database and schedule as a view on this database. Since this database obviously doesn't give you all the attributes, you have to put in a liberal amount of nulls. Okay? So you would say the movie really is null, null, null genre from S4. Okay? That's the only thing that you can get. The only piece of movie that you can get from S4 is genre. Right? And similarly, the only piece of schedule you can get from S4 for schedule, only piece of schedule that you can get from S4 is cinema. Right? Okay? So I will say this is this piece of this database. This is this piece of this database. Reasonable. Okay? Now, obviously, if I ask a question, which cinemas are playing comedies? Right? If I go here, I can answer that. There's no way I can answer this here. Do you see that? Okay? Because, in essence, it's interesting to see that this problem could go away if you wind up putting extra relations here. You can always increase the number of relations in the global, in the virtual schema. Okay? I can, for example, make a relation called S4 relation. It will be called S4 relation, for want of a better term. Okay? Which will have cinema and genre as the only pieces that are there. And of course, not surprisingly, S4 relation is exact view on S4. Then you can answer it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now the problem, of course, is you are changing virtual schema based on the sources. Oftentimes, what would more likely happen is you would have decided what your virtual schema is, and then you're trying to map the sources onto it. Okay. Now, at least this problem doesn't exist on the local S view. Okay, so for example, here I get to write source S4 is really a specific view on this big database. Okay, it's really this query, select cinema and genre from movie M and schedule S, where M title equal to S title. And with this mapping, you can actually ask queries on this, and the reformulation algorithms would let you realize that there's in fact a direct way of answering a query of the type, which cinemas are playing comedies, by sending it to S4. Okay, yes?
Because we are expecting
No, yes, yes. As I said, you can always, you can either change the existing relations or introduce new relations as soon as new sources are discovered. If you do that, there is no problem. Okay? But normally you would like to standardize beforehand. You have come up with some description of the world. All I'm saying is, whatever description you pick, as long as you guarantee me that you don't keep changing your description, you know, middle description, whatever description you will pick, I can come up with sources which cannot be properly mapped onto your description. Not surprising at all. Not surprising at all. I mean, you know, any of you who have tried to put your unique biodata onto specific forms that have been created by government organizations back in 1930, know that, you know, for example, half of the world thinks that my last name is Kamthamp because they only have so many words for the last name and I have little more letters, and so the rest of it is gone. Okay? Of course, as you said, you know, if you and I have our way, we will change the form. For Rao, a separate form is created. And as soon as new immigrants come, they start changing. And I'm sure, you know, for Vietnamese names, they would need some of those funny, nice little thingies on top too, you know. But we are talking about, given a decision, you know, about what your schema, mediator schema is, this one is more likely to be lossy than this, at least. This example shows you that. Okay. Now, having said all this, I want you to think about how much of any of this matters in the data aggregation scenario. In the data aggregation scenario, there is only one relation here, and each of these are just pieces of that relation. Okay, turns out really not much. In fact, it turns out for the data aggregation scenarios, global as you, local as you, as far as I could tell, I was trying to think about this while before coming to class today, I couldn't see any difference. Okay, which is part of the reason why I've decided, since most of the existing ones that I will talk to you about data integration systems are aggregation systems, I'll skip the details, the beautiful details about how to reformulate a query made on the virtual schema into queries onto sources when you have local as view. Global as view, it's obvious, right? You just macro expansion. For the global as view, it's not macro expansion, and you need to actually do slightly more interesting stuff. But I will skip those details. Okay. So this is, you know, the usual difference between these two, and I think the main point is global as view is best when you know what are your sources and they're stable. So if you know these are the 15 sources that you're ever going to mediate over, if you knew S4 is part of your sources, right, you would not have come up with movie and schedule in that form as the virtual schema. You could have come up with something different upfront. So if you know the sources and they're stable, and people don't keep adding more sources, that's global as view is better, okay? And it's also, these are sources that are known to the mediator. In that case, global as view is much better. Whereas, if you have many relatively unknown sources and new sources can keep coming in, and you have to make up your mind upfront at the time mediator is being designed, what your standard is. See, I mean, at the time the census form was designed, they decided, even though many people had last names like Smith, they still didn't go for last name to be exactly 5 letters long. Okay, they took some extra, you know, blanks for more immigrants with longer names to come from Germany and all those things. They didn't count on people from my part of the region coming, and so, you know, I still can't get into the Census Bureau. But the point is, if you know, if you have to make a decision based on whatever you know, and then more things can keep coming, you're better off going with local as you. Okay. And there are systems for both of these, but all of these are research systems. Okay, none of them have been actually fielded. There is no .com site that you can use. And all the .com sites that exist are all data aggregation systems. Okay. There are very interesting research problems in the context of query reformulation, etc. here, but with those caveats. Any questions on anything I've said till now? Yes. So what is the situation for data warehousing? It's a totally orthogonal issue. You could decide to do, so this is very important to understand. And in fact, I was going to make this hierarchical picture myself. I just, you know, felt lazy. You should make it yourself at some place. If you have decided to do data integration, you get to either do warehousing or virtual integration, okay? If you're doing warehousing, you can forget about all this stuff. Because you get all the data and you put it in your local database and whichever way you want. Okay, at the time you put it, you throw away some pieces and you keep some pieces, that's it. And the user doesn't know any better. You know, they're only working on this database that you have stored. So these issues are kind of, they become moot. You know, they're not even there because you already decided to make the right copies of the outside information, put it in a single database. The whole issue of these global as view, local as view issues are much more relevant for the virtual mediation where, in fact, you have a mediator schema and the sources still exist separately. Okay? Okay. So what I'm going to do now is something that basically is more about query processing in the context of data integration. Okay, much of what we have done till now, such as global as view, local as view, etc., these are about modeling phase itself. So how do you want to model mediator schema versus individual source schema? Okay, now suppose I actually have modeled and I have picked some particular approach, let's say local as view or global as view, then, and there is a query in the mediator, the question is, what is the best way to process it on the sources? What's the optimal way to process it on the sources? Okay, notice that query optimization is an issue in single databases where none of these modeling issues have existed. It's still an important problem, I know, in the single databases. What's the right way to run the query? So I want to bring up some of the query optimization issues and discuss some of the interesting differences between the traditional optimization in databases and the kinds of things that you would have to do in this context of integration scenarios. Okay, much of the discussion here is really going to be about data aggregation scenario, okay, because most of the systems that I'm aware of actually wind up doing data aggregation, and there are, and so I'll basically look at specifically at the data aggregation, okay, and even there are interesting issues. Okay, so a couple of points before we go on is deciding what to optimize in the context of data integration versus traditional databases. The second is, how do I get information about the sources? Now, previously the information was schema information, okay? But to actually do optimization, you need more than schema information. You need information such as, for example, which source is likely to be fast, which source is likely to be slow, which source is likely to be fast now that it is 12 o'clock in the morning, 12 noon in Arizona. And which sources are likely to be slower at the same time, okay? Which source is likely to be complete for my query? Which source is likely to give more results to my query, okay? If you have all this extra information, then you can decide the optimal way, or more optimal way to run this query and get the answer, okay? So in essence, I want even more information about the sources than is present in just the schema information. And this should not be surprising to you. You know, databases, there's a schema stage, and then when you get to the query processing, you're not just, you know, mucking around the schema. You're talking about things like cardinalities, selectivities, all that fun stuff, which are even lower level numbers, which the user doesn't need to know. But we are no longer talking about the user here. We are talking about the mediator, which has the query, and it's trying to make a decision as to how fast to run this query. Okay? So getting that extra information that you need from the sources, it turns out that's an issue because the sources don't know that the mediator exists oftentimes, and so you may have to learn this. You may have to gather this yourself. And then doing the optimization, okay? Now, let's look at those three pieces, except something happened. Well, let's look at this issue first. Oh well, I just have to talk to you directly. Oh, okay, there you go. Okay. So the first question is what to optimize. Now, in normal databases, what do you optimize? Time taken. Because everything else is already decided up front. Okay. Every query has a correct number of answers, and everybody must give all the answers, and the only thing that differs is who gives it fast. Okay. Now, what's interesting actually is all you care is, when I say time taken, what do you mean? Suppose I have 2,000 tuples for this query. What is the time that you are counting? Now, after you give the query, till you get what? You think first, and you think all. Which is the one that database people care about? All. All. The only thing is all. Okay? So there's only one thing is time. In fact, the very fact that you differ means time, there are different times. Okay? But database people don't care about that because they're actually decided the standard is from the time of the query to the time of the last tuple. And you can't, you know, muck around with what is the last tuple because every query has the right number of answers. You can't just give one tuple and that's my last tuple. Okay? So everything is standardized from the beginning to the end. That's the time, and you maximize that. I mean, sorry, not maximize, minimize that. Okay. Now, it's clear that that's not the only thing that you want to optimize, especially on the internet. You know, the very fact that you're thinking the first means we're always looking at how fast is the Google's 10 results come. You're not talking about how fast will the 10,955 pages are being sent to you, because they don't even send you the rest. They only send the first 10. The question is, how fast do you get the first 10? Okay. So even from the time, so databases only care about the full time, but even from the time point of view in, you know, doing optimization on the web, you're interested, more interested in both how fast can you get the tuples, first tuples, and how long will the total time. Now, which is the right answer, I don't know. Now, some people want, I guess clearly you want your first tuple to come right now, and then the second tuple can come maybe day after tomorrow, and maybe you won't mind. Whereas somebody else might want, I don't really care how fast your first tuple is. By the time you give me the last tuple, it better be not more than 1 hour. Okay, now who is right? Nobody is right. You know, it's like this question of, in travel scenarios, I might want to go as fast as possible. I don't care as much about how much money I spend. And you want to spend as little money as possible. You don't really care about how many days you sleep in the airport. And who is right? Both of us are right. It depends on our metric. Okay. The important thing is, originally, in traditional databases, there's only one metric. Everybody has decided. You've been told that your metric would be from the beginning to the end time. Okay, but once you start opening the Pandora's box, you realize that people can have different optimization criteria. So there is first tuples, how fast are the first tuples coming? There's also the total amount of time taken. And in fact, a more general issue of what is the rate at which the new tuples are being produced. In fact, you know, I might argue that the way to keep users glued to the screen is to find the right clip at which the tuples keep coming. And so they are just hypnotized by them coming and they won't go to any other source. Okay? So that's a useful thing to do. Okay. So there's the total time of execution, there's a cost to first few tuples. Okay. Those are two different things that you have to care about. More importantly, you want to care about coverage of the plan. Okay, so the issue is, do I want all the answers to this query? Okay, do I want, some of the answers to this query? Okay. It may well be that if I want 90% of the answers to this query, I would need to call, you know, 15 sources to give that guarantee. Whereas if I just don't mind, you know, with 85%, it may be that I can just call 5 sources and get you 85% of the answers. Okay? Depending upon how complete your answer, you want your answer to be, you may have to spend more time. If you just want top 10, you know, Google gives it right away. Top 3,000, you can just keep saying page. And if you want all the tuples that they wrote are there, all the pages that they wrote are actually available, you need to do that recursive query expansion, which we talked about earlier, which is fun, but it takes longer time. Okay? So you need to decide what are you trying to optimize for. Okay, it was, the query is the same. These are all extra pieces that you're thinking about now. Okay, how complete do you want your answer to be? And not surprisingly, the more complete you want your answer to be, the longer it might take, because the more sources you might have to call and the more time you have to wait, you know, collating all the results and so on. And which is the right one? It depends on your metric. Okay. The other interesting thing that is brought up because of the coverage, so for example, so if you want to do this, let's say, if you want to do this total time of execution, etc., versus cost to first tuple, what kind of information do you need? Suppose all I care is reduce the time, and somehow coverage has been standardized. Everybody still wants 100% coverage, and you just want to get reduce the time. Okay, what kind of information do I need to decide which sources to access? So you need information, for example, about latencies. Okay, so how long does a source take before it gets back to you when you send a query? Okay, the slow sources might likely take longer time. Okay, and if you want high coverage, of course, so you want, for this aspect, you want information about how slow versus fast are the sources. Now, the interesting part is it's not required that the sources are uniformly slow versus uniformly fast for every query. It's possible that certain sources are very fast for certain types of queries and much slower for certain other types of queries. In fact, this is not at all surprising. We'll talk about some actual experiments showing that based on the query, you know, if you have a form where you get to fill certain fields and send it as a query to the source, okay, depending on which ones you fill and which ones you leave empty, it can take more versus less time to start giving you answers. Because it depends on how much time, you know, is being taken. So in terms of latency, what you're talking about is the query to go to the source to actually process the query, and the answers to start coming to you. That's what you're counting. Okay? And those will depend not just on the source, but it can also depend on the query that you're sending. What else can latency depend on? What? Network latency. Well, yeah. But I mean, can you predict network latency? Again, one of the interesting things is when we are talking about, the thing that I'm pushing you towards is essentially what sorts of information can I gather about the sources such that I can use it to improve the query processing. What? Okay, so that's the second one. So in this case, basically, even in terms of time, I might want to know, for example, where in the world this source is. Because in essence, what happens is the latency might be time dependent. You know, you wouldn't have been, you're not surprised, and most graduate students are trawling the web late in the night because, you know, that's when there's much less traffic on the web. Of course, graduate students create most of the traffic, so in fact, probably midnight is the worst time to trawl the web, but that's a different story. So there are times too. So in fact, the latency is a function of the query type, it's a function of the time. And you want to learn these numbers. Nobody is going to give these to you. Okay, so you may want to learn these numbers and use them later on. Okay. Now, in terms of the coverage of the plan, what sorts of information do you need? you would need how big is the source, how many tuples is this source going to give you. Okay, once again, it's not just how big a single source, how big is this big, this one source versus this second source, but really how much, how many answers this source is likely to give for query Q, and how many answers it's likely to give here. So for example, if my query is about Woody Allen movies, it's not necessary, or maybe Zhang Yimou movies, it's not necessary that the largest movie database is the one which will give me the most tuples on Zhang Yimou movies. Right? It may be that a movie database that concentrates more on Chinese English movies would have more information on that than IMDb does. Okay? So once again, the argument there is, yes, you need to characterize coverage, how big are the sources, how many tuples a source is supposed to give you, is likely to give. But you also want to characterize it not just at a source level, but at a source and query level. So for a query, which source is likely to give more answers? Okay. Now the second question, of course, is if I have two big sources for a query, Q, okay, and this source says I'll give you 90% of the tuples for this query, and this source also says I'll give you 85% of the tuples for this query, and a third source says I'll give you, you know, 15% of the tuples for this query. So now if I have to call one source, which would I call? The first one, the 90%. If I have to call two sources, which one I call? It's not at all obvious. You know, I mean, I would really like to hope that 90 plus 85, that's much higher coverage than 100%, which is nice. Except clearly 90 and 85 means they're likely to have humongous amount of overlap. It may actually be that the 85 source is a percentage of the first source. So calling it is useless, completely useless. So it's not enough just to know what is, how big is the answer set that this source is going to give you, but also you might want to know how likely is it that the answers this guy is giving have already been given by somebody who came before it. For that you need to characterize overlap. Now once again, overlap needs to be characterized with respect to the source, with respect to queries, rather than with respect to just sources as a whole. Okay, as a whole, the sources might have, you know, 80% common tuples, but for a particular query you have, they have zero tuples common. It's possible, because the query is a subset of these two sets. And those subsets could be disjoint, while the big sets have humongous, you know, overlap. Okay, so what we're going to do next class, essentially, is talk about how to go about getting these kinds of statistics, the coverage and overlap statistics. Okay. And also how to go about getting these latency statistics, and end with how do I combine both. Okay, how would I actually, if I have both latency and coverage and overlap statistics, what does it even mean to optimize a query? That's like, if I know both how costly a particular travel plan is and how long it takes, then what am I supposed to show you in terms of the best plan for you? Well, really, it's clear that, you know, if you are showing me one plan, one travel plan which is $1,000 costly and takes 10 hours to go, and you're showing me another plan which is $2,000 costly and takes 20 hours to go, you're wasting my time. Okay? So you should not be showing me plans that are dominated by each other. And plans are not dominated if at least they are good in one aspect compared to the other plan. And this brings up this issue of optimizing with respect to multiple objectives, which is called multi-objective optimization. We'll talk about that and what we can do with these statistics in the query process. Okay? That's what we'll do next class.